All right, guys. Welcome back to another episode of The Art Beat on CITR 101.9 FM, formerly known as The Arts Report, but still put on by the CITR Arts Collective. Today is Wednesday, March 12th, and wow, we're just a couple days away from the start of spring, so that's awesome. Not that you would be able to tell, because it looks like rain for the entire rest of the month. But we are broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia Vancouver campus, which is unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. Indigenous voices in so-called Canada have been systematically devalued and diminished, and this cannot go unacknowledged in broadcast media such as radio. To hear more, please listen to Unceded Airwaves from CITR's Indigenous Collective. My name is Serena, and I'm joined in the studio today by a host of lovely people. But first, before we do our introductions, I want to take a second and say that we are doing our limited series right now called Everything But the Peace. This is the second of four episodes where... this is the second of four episodes where we are looking at art and the institution. Sorry, we were having some technical difficulties there for a second. And yeah, so we have some amazing interviews here today. But before I get into our show schedule, I want to take a second and acknowledge our positionality in this, especially in line with our land acknowledgement that we just did, which is that we all do work for CITR and we do work for UBC effectively, which situates us within the institution. So even though we're taking a look at institutions and some of the positives and negatives of those spaces, we're not far removed from them. And it means that we start out all of our soul searching about this topic with UBC. So a lot of our interviews that we're doing in this series are UBC centered, and UBC is not innocent in terms of diminishing and devaluing Indigenous traditions in Vancouver. So I just want to take a second to acknowledge that. And I'm going to pass it to Ava here now, who's going to tell us a little bit more about UBC as an institution and how that affects these kind of art world spaces that UBC does host.
Yeah, so even though UBC is not, you know, primarily an art school, there is still art programming here at UBC and art spaces. So I first want to highlight the Morrison Helen Belkin Gallery, which actually has free admission. And this is a topic that we'll be getting into a little bit more later. And it hosts more than 4,500 artworks. It was originally founded as the Fine Art Gallery in 1948 with a focus on contemporary art. But nowadays it houses the university's art collection. And given it is an art institution within the university, as that within its role here, it's mandated to research, exhibit, collect, publish, educate, and develop programs in the field of contemporary art and contemporary approaches to art history and art criticism. As well, in its role, it commissions public art pieces for the university campus, and we're going to talk about one of those pieces, specifically Wood for the People, which Django knows a little bit more about.
There's this one piece called Wood for the People that I took a art history course, and it was one that I'd walked by every day from the car park to Buchanan, and it just looks like a stack of wood, and I just thought it was a stack of wood, but it's made of concrete, so it's not wood at all. But I just thought that's an interesting thing that there is a bunch of public art on campus that we walk around every day, and it's just through the Belkin, which is kind of cool that it's a part of their collection. But just that's kind of in line with being a viewer, and there's art all around us on campus from this institution that is based on campus, but they sneak it. they sneak it by us. It's kind of fun. Yeah. I don't know.
It's really interesting. Yeah. There's actually nearly 30 public art pieces on our campus that have been commissioned by this gallery, although most of these commissions were back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and there hasn't been as many recently. So it would be really good if we could see a resurgence in this funding for there to be more public art on campus. Now shifting our focus to another free exhibition space on campus, there's the Art History and Visual Art Gallery, which is another contemporary exhibit, and it showcases both student and faculty work, and actually how pieces end up in this gallery is through the recommendation of professors, which is really interesting because it's the art professors here at campus who are almost functioning as art curators. Mm. And I wanted to pass it over to Lily to talk about her experience being featured in this gallery.
Yeah, it was very fun. It was in my second year of university. The exhibit, I'm pretty positive, was the BFA and BA second and third year exhibition, which was very fun. It basically just came around and my professor emailed me and said, I like your work from your final project. Do you want it to be put in this gallery? And honestly, even though shockingly, I actually hated the work that was put up, I felt very honored. And I mean, how can you say no to an opportunity like that, especially just in the art world in general? It's very hard to even have your name mentioned in the process of all these works, considering that there was a lot of students up for the gallery opening. Fun fact, I actually had the flu during the opening, so felt very ill during that, but I persevered. And it was a really fun opportunity to also just see all these showcased pieces of my classmates as well, because many people that I knew within my class as well as other classes were all exhibited, and it was just a really nice opportunity to see all these works of students at UBC.
Something I'm just thinking of when you're saying this is, we're going to get into this a little bit more with one of our interviews later on in the episode, but the idea of like handing over the definitive power, like the power to define art and to kind of curate and like say what goes and what doesn't go to like an institutional body like the school or like the state or like your profs, who I'm assuming not every single student's art was featured. So it's like we've now given power to this like higher force to like decide what is good and what isn't good and what's essentially not worthy of being brought out into the art world in a greater sense. And so I think that one of the themes that we're talking about a lot in this episode is this kind of tension between UBC spaces or student run spaces as like legitimate like art spaces, but also sitting kind of more peripherally to the art world, quote unquote, in its like kind of more massive form. So we're definitely going to be taking a look at kind of what these different gallery spaces look like. And I want to take some time now to introduce our first interview, which is with the lovely Lily Lester, who is the Hatch director and also a dear friend. And we're so happy that she could come on the show today. That we could do the interview that could be aired today. Lily is a fourth year art history honors student, and she uses she, her pronouns, and she's currently the director and curator of the Hatch Art Gallery, which also, interestingly enough, is a paid AMS position. So this is like an official professional curatorial role, but it also is, obviously, the Hatch is nestled within the Nest, which is the same student building that CITR is. So we're kind of, I also want to say, actually, if you've been a listener for a little while now, you know that we actually did do an exhibition in November at the Hatch, so we are quite well oriented in that space. But I'm going to give it away to Lily now to talk about the Hatch and also her experience just being both a student in this institution and also working for it in a lot of ways. So here we go.
We are UBC Electronica, and we love electronic music sessions. Run for them life when I step into the jungle. We offer DJ workshops, open decks, pop-up parties, and more. Follow our socials such as Instagram, Discord, or join us through email, ubcelectronica@gmail.com.
Attention, all artists, zine makers, writers, musicians, community organizers, activists, anarchists, proles, punks, and weirdos. Are you screaming for your voice to be heard? Do you resist capitalism and colonialism? Are you angry about the current political climate and ready to act up about it? Well, we want you here. The second annual Anarchist Book Fair is now looking for creatives, creators, activists, and organizations who engage in community building, mutual aid, active resistance, skill building, and knowledge sharing to table booths and propose workshops. This is an anarchist space, which means it opposes hierarchies and seeks to amplify unheard voices and build communities of mutual aid and support. First come, first serve. 50% of tables reserved for marginalized voices. Email sponsorship@citr.ca before March 27th. sponsorship@citr.ca. sponsorship@citr.ca.
Yeah, absolutely. To discuss kind of the idea of what the Hatch is and also to like introduce it a little bit as a gallery. So the Hatch is one of the only student-run art galleries in Western Canada, and we've been around for quite some time. We have a permanent art collection that is highly valued, and that exhibits kind of once a year. And then for the rest of the year, it's just a rotation of whatever the director and the exhibition team wishes to do. So there's a lot of freedom in being able to curate what you want, go with your passions. But yeah, kind of in like discussion of like the non-art institution, I would say working within the AMS UBC is a very unique situation because while it offers a broader platform for engagement, it isn't at its core an art institution, so it doesn't have kind of the knowledge and backbone behind it to support an art institution, while they still have quite a bit of, you know, we have a art subcommittee that has other members of the surrounding UBC arts to support us. So it's not like we don't feel supported at all, but it's just definitely not an embedded art culture district in itself. In terms of like limitations, I feel like navigating institutional structures is always difficult as a student. As someone who's only 21 years old, I kind of learn things as I go and my team learns things as I go. I feel like the institution doesn't prioritize or understand the value of art as the same way that an art-focused institution would. Just as its like basis, it has different programming. However, I feel like I see these barriers as opportunities to advocate. And due to it like not being an art institution, we can kind of have more of a voice as the group that's able to portray out to the communities.
Yeah, totally. One of the things that's kind of striking me when you're saying all of that is that you have this like dual identity of you are an art history student and you're also doing this professional job like within the art world. And I know from my experience working with the Arts Collective, a little bit different obviously than your role, but I also have that kind of peripheral job within the arts world in a larger sense, like off UBC campus, we talk about curators and galleries and things like that. So we're kind of asked to like play these two roles of like a student, someone that's like potentially looking into going into the art world in the future, but also like actually actively working in it as well. So I guess what do you get from that?
Yeah, I think as a student, you're able to understand a little bit more of like the limitations of how students also operate as artists. You're kind of working directly eye to eye with them on the same level versus being an overarching kind of power over artists as a curator. So I feel like in that sense, it's nice to be a student and like that dual role. I also think though, being on the periphery of like the professional art world, being kind of a bit on the outside in the hatchway, I think there's a bit of a separation in how us as students are either viewed in the outside art world, just since we're so tucked away in our own little corner of UBC. And it's a bit hard to break out of that mold as a student-ran gallery. I think the integrity of the gallery is so much more than being defined as just student-ran, as like the art that we are exhibiting, even though it is students, it doesn't need to be limited to that. I think they're all artists in their own right. I think, though, it's kind of nice to be on the outside because then we're not, I'm not immersed in the pressures that the other galleries are held to, and our like deadlines and our boundaries can be a little more fluid and in line with how students view the world. So we can connect on that way. So I do quite enjoy being on the outside. And we can also experiment a little bit more with our exhibitions, and we can have the freedom to embrace whatever we wish, collaborate with groups we want to, discuss topics that we wish to, and interact with communities that I, as a director, want to raise. On the other hand, like, now taking on this role as curator and student at the same time, I'm getting a glimpse of what the professional world looks like, and I'm understanding how much it takes and how much you really need to devote yourself and throw yourself into it. It's something that I'm willing to do and I'm happy to do continuously, and I think that's something that in my program we are proud of doing. A lot of my exhibition team wants to throw themselves into it. However, it's not a thing that we take lightly, as it does like take a lot of our emotional time, physical time. So I think in that case, the complexities of the art world and understanding how to just be a curator and lead a team does connect with like, okay, this is a lot. Like, this is a lot of work. This is something that you know, needs to have more thought put into it, which is why I think it's really important though. Like, my team is getting firsthand hard skills in the art gallery before they're able to almost test it. They test it out here before they apply it to the real world in a job that they're gonna, you know, be applying and hired for. So I think it gives a lot of students the ability to fail. Like, I'm not holding anyone on their failures. I'm like, if you fail, I think that's a good thing. Like, I think if we don't understand how to install something or like our media goes awry, I think that's a good thing, because then we know how to proceed in the future professionally. But that in regards to like my own professionalism, I think it's just really giving me a chance to understand more of my place in the art world and understand like where I could move with it. So I think the Hatch has given me a huge ability to like test myself and put myself out there, still kind of just going with the flow and seeing how things work for my next years. Since I'm graduating this year, I kind of just want to let opportunities come as they come and not say no to anything. I think that's really important at this age, is just do things that you want to do, follow your passions, follow your heart.
Yeah, totally. One of the things I just want to pull out of what you're saying that was kind of, I don't know, holding on to that you were saying a little bit earlier, was about how there's that kind of tension almost with this being like a student-led space, and like how that is in some ways like devalued a little bit within the greater art world, and also the fact that it is like on UBC campus in a building that houses non-art facilities, that like this is a gallery space as any other in Vancouver. These artists are like, artists can be any age, art can be anything, obviously. Like, this is, these categories are so arbitrary, and within the art world we love to be elitist and I want to say like intellectualize it and be like, wow, well, you know, art is what you make it, and like artists are what you make it, but then on the day-to-day they still function as institutions, and they do have, like you said, rigid structures and expectations, and they do fall into the own traps, like traps of their own making of, oh, this isn't valid, or this isn't up to standard. And it's like, you, this is just something I've seen, and it's like, you're a curator that loves to be like, ooh, we're pushing the boundaries, we're doing this, we're doing that, but then it's like, when it comes down to it, you're also participating in this kind of elitism that's keeping people out of the art world. So do you see the Hatch as like a more open space? I know that you're talking a lot about how it's student-led, and one of the things I was getting from what you're just saying is that you felt like it was a bit of a crash test before people go out into the greater world. Do you see the Hatch like situated within the rest of Vancouver galleries, Vancouver art world, as that crash test, or do you see it like in its own right?
I think that's the tricky part, is because like how I've discussed this like crash test idea, I think it's difficult then to like broach that out to the professional world and not see them just view us as students. I think inherently that's always how we're going to be viewed first and foremost outside of it. I think it's breaking out of that mold that is quite difficult. In terms of like the rigidness of a white box gallery, inherently this is how this gallery was created. It was created incredibly It's very stereotypical. It's also very sterile. Yeah. It's a white wall. You know, the walls have to be repainted. They need to do everything each time. There's a limit to what we're able to put up and what we're able to choose for an exhibition. So I think that is really where there's certain levels of, I don't want to say elitism, but like it is curated to an extent. So we aren't able, if you wish, as a director, you can put as much as you want top to bottom on the walls. But I think in a certain extent, by being selective and curating pieces from students, you're at the same time trying to position yourself higher in the art world by having a very stereotypical art gallery. But at the same time, you're limiting that student-ran space because you're rejecting students who've put hard effort into their pieces for, yeah, arbitrary reasons if it is student-ran. To go back to like your first point as well is like just being like in the nest. I think there's a difficulty in creating an aura of the space in many ways. When our doors are open, we're prone to the sounds of the nest. Typically, when you enter in an art gallery, it can be quiet. It's an experience. You're able to be one with the pieces. And while that's a very rigid experience in as itself, I think being in the nest and being in such a loud environment can somehow inhibit that experience, as well as at certain openings and whatnot. But it is a privilege to be in a space that's like in the corner and have people able to enter. I think that enables more people who might not necessarily know about the hatch to just wander in and see the space. So I think in that way, just being able to anyone to enter, I think in as itself is a way of breaking down boundaries of the richness of a gallery. I think people at times are nervous or scared or don't they feel really out of place by entering in the gallery. But by the doors just being open, by having a friendly attendant just be like, come in and have like a safe space for people to experience art and also just to take a step back from school. I think in that way it breaks down the barriers. But yeah, we still have to uphold certain artistic values that are instilled in us almost in the art history program. We break down as much as possible, but we're not yet kind of at that point where we understand the meaning behind absolutely everything. So it's tricky. It's tricky to work through. But in as itself, the nest is something that the directors have to work through, but they're able to pull through typically.
Yeah, one of the things I'm just getting from what you're saying is that like approachability as an audience member, and I think that that's very true because oftentimes, like not exclusively, there's some galleries that do a good job of bringing in like people off the street, but this does have like a certain kind of unique appeal in that it is embedded inside of like a place that has like so many different people. And I think that because, like you were saying, it's student-led and the art featured is mostly students' work, it's like people who aren't really acquainted with the art world might feel more comfortable to just like come in, take a peek, look around from like an observer's perspective. But I wonder what like limit that has to them actually engaging in like participating.
Yeah, I think like to just pull upon like what we're currently doing, something that I always knew was going to happen since September that I wanted to put up is a collaboration with the Design Undergraduate Society, DESIS. So the exhibition we have right now is called Bionic Worlds, and the pieces that are exhibited in the hatch have never been exhibited before in an art gallery or even in the context of art. So I was really inspired by a class by a professor named Riley in the Sala department, and was basically to reimagine organs as either like design pieces, fixtures, lights, whatever, and the students were given complete freedom and autonomy over their work. And I saw those and I was really inspired. So I wanted to curate an exhibition for those pieces. And our opening on Monday was full of students who've never entered the hatch before. Like, bringing more people into it is a part of being the director. Like, you want to be doing that inherently in your work. And I think if you're limiting yourself to just very stereotypical painting art, you're not going to be getting new audiences into it. So I do think it's breaking down the idea of what can be exhibited in here, having performance art, having architectural models, having pinups, having things that aren't really typically art, brings more people into the space. And like, we don't necessarily care. I think it's like something that we're happy to have anyone be a part of. We don't want to limit people's experiences, and we want everyone's experiences to be valid. So we're happy to welcome anyone to the space, and whatever they take out of it, they take out of it. And if you find something new and you learn something about yourself, that's kind of the best thing that we want to have.
Yeah.
One of the last things I just want to touch on, what is it like to actually work within the structure of UBC and that hierarchy? Because that's not an expectation that the Vancouver Art Gallery, James Black, like any of these other spaces that we're talking about, that you are like in some sense akin to, have to go through. They don't have this like really just deeply entrenched level of like bureaucracy. So do you find any benefits to that? Do you find any, you know, negative aspects to that?
I think it's half and half, and I think it depends on almost the director's ability to communicate this with the other groups. I think the university allows me to have an interdisciplinary approach to curating. I have access to more diverse intellectual communities. I have more access to other professors that I wouldn't necessarily work with. And I feel like a huge thing, I have access to grants and I have access to communities that are willing to support me that art galleries have to continuously search for. So I think in that case, UBC is a huge, huge, huge support to be able to have that. So I think in terms of like being able to have community and being able to have advocacy as well within art, being at UBC is a huge plus. But at the same time, of course, I think when I position myself within these meetings, within these communities as just a student curator, I don't want to show up to this meeting as someone who is lower than in terms of it, just because of my status as a student. I want to position myself akin with these people as colleagues, because I think that's just an important thing for us as students to be doing, to be working with faculty, to be working with UBC side by side. So I think the Hatch has a huge ability to do that, but it really just depends on the comfortability of the curator and how they're able to position themselves. But yeah, there's wins and there's losses.
Okay, well, that's pretty much all that we have for today, but thank you so much, Lily. That was incredible. Do you have any closing thoughts? You should plug the Hatch a little bit here.
Well, first, thank you so much. That was epic. Our plug is basically just that we have a few more exhibitions going up to the end of the year. Our design one is going to be closed on this Friday, and then we're going to be prepping a slow fashion exhibition with Germaine Coe on March 21st to the 27th, ending with a huge fashion show on March 27th. So check out our Instagram for that. Everything will be posted on the Hatch Art Gallery and Slow Fashion Season Instagram accounts. And lastly, we're going to be having our final exhibition that the exhibition team of the Hatch solo curated themselves. And that'll be from April 7th to the 30th with an opening on April 11th. And that'll be our final exhibition of the year. So if you want your art to be in the Hatch, this is your last chance. So check out the Instagram account. And yeah, that's my plug. Thank you.
Thank you.
Devin Cole is a woman in total control. Unafraid and unashamed, Cole has burst onto the scene through her expertly crafted feminist pop anthems, packaging social truths into repeat-worthy bops. This is the era of fempop, and Devin Cole is an artist you don't want to miss. Join Devin Cole on her Two Shades Blonder tour and see her in Vancouver at the Biltmore Cabaret on March 16th. To find out more and get your tickets, visit admitone.com. That's admitone.com. But I'm a fiend for the troublesome boy who's driving me wild, keeping me on the tip of my tongue. Yeah.
All right, welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening to The Art Beat, and we're doing our limited series right now called Everything But the Piece, where we're looking at that kind of relationship between the artist, the art, the middleman of the curator or gallery space, and the audience. So you just heard an interview from Lily Lester, who is the Hatch director this year, and we are so grateful to have that interview with her. We want to talk a little bit about how these spaces kind of emanate different auras or different energies depending on where they physically are and how institutional they actually are. Because one of the things that I'm thinking about after listening to this interview for the second or third time is how the Hatch has a different standing than something like James Black that we mentioned, or Western Front, which is an artist-led space, or something like the Vancouver Art Gallery, which is a very institutional and kind of, I don't want to say tourist-like, but it's very, it's kind of known on the world stage. It's like a Vancouver fixture. So these spaces all, when you go into them, you have different preconceptions of what you're getting. And because of that, the curatorial teams for these places are kind of going to be putting out different messages just simply depending on the different spaces that they're in. So I know Maya wanted to talk a little bit about an experience that her and I had at the Vancouver Art Gallery last year. So Maya, if you want to get into that.
No, yeah, just kind of going off of that. This past summer, Shrin and I went to a zine exhibit at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
It was called Copy Machine Manifestos, for the record.
Which was actually super awesome, super beautiful. Got to see so much, like, actually, beautiful, beautiful, like, zines and just, like, the way that they've, like, changed over time. But something that Shrin and I were really talking about kind of afterwards was how strange it is almost that zines, which are very much an alternative form of media, they very much go against the institution.
They're very counterculture.
Very, very counterculture. They're used in social justice spaces because they are, like, they don't cost a lot of money to make. They are easy to give out to the public. And the fact that now they're being kind of put behind glass in a space that you have to pay money for in this big, like, fancy, like, art institution, it felt very strange because I've paid to get into this institution. I'm looking at these, like zines that are talking about, like, political uprisings or, like, just, like, counterculture in general through a, like, glass box.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt very, like, I would be very curious to know, like, what the, like, curation about that mm-hmm. was, because I understand, like, looking at zines through a more critical lens.
It almost feels like taking the tools out of, like, the people's hands, and it's, like, mm-hmm. it's a weird duality because on one side, like, yeah, a lot of these artists are really proud of their work, and, like, it is really good work, and it was honestly, like, I know it was a huge undertaking to actually curate that exhibit because it was the largest collection of zines ever put together, ever. It's, like, as a whole. So it was, like, a huge body of work and, like, a really beautiful exhibition, but it's also, like, huh, this is something that you would just happen upon, and this is something that is used to get out messages and is often very, like, explicit or has a lot of, like, queer justice messaging and things like that. And so I'm looking at these zines from, like, Kathleen Hanna or, like, from, like, the Riot Girl movement in, like, the 80s and the 90s, but it's also all under glass at the Vancouver Art Gallery, which is, like, you know, you walk up these, like, steps to get in there, and it's definitely, like, a strange dissonance there. I know Django wanted to speak to a little bit about the Vancouver Art Gallery as well. Not to hate on it too much, because I do love the Vancouver Art Gallery, but it is very institutional.
And this isn't really a hate on thing, just something I was talking with my mom yesterday about.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out Natasha. About places where protest happens, and we were talking about a lot of, like, college campuses across North America, really, and how that usually is the place where mass protest does, and then comparing that with UBC, which is in its physical location outside of the realm of the city of Vancouver. It's, like, not in the municipality. So the space for protest is kind of out of the way for a lot of people who are not directly involved in the university. And the place that happens, or where protest happens normally in Vancouver, is the Art Gallery. And I just thought that was a really interesting thing because, like, why is that the reason that it is? Obviously, it's a central location. It's an institution. Like, is that the reason why? Is it just a great meeting place in the city? Like, is it purely physical? Or is it something to do with the actual building that they're protesting outside of?
Well, that's also the thing, is, like, the building itself, like I was trying to say, it's, like, it's a fixture. It's an institutional fixture. And it does carry so much weight to have these protests there and to have that be the backdrop
mm-hmm.
rather than another space that is in itself, like, a lot more justice oriented. But yeah, I don't know, it makes me think definitely a lot. And one of the interviews, or our last interview that we're going to get into later on in this episode, is going to be with Sean Dacey of the Richmond Art Gallery, which is actually a public gallery. It's free, it's publicly funded, and it's a municipal space, which means that the level of bureaucracy they undergo is very much existent, but it is so much more with the city and less with, like, the art world, quote unquote. So it's really interesting to think about how these spaces differ, but how they also have, like, similarities also. I want to pass it to Mickey now, who's going to talk about an interview that she did earlier. If you want to introduce the interview, Mickey.
Yeah. So first, hello. And then, yeah, I'll introduce who the person is first. Jennifer Kramer, has a joint position as an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at UBC, and that makes up about 40% of her time. And then 60%, she is a curator, and she's responsible for the Pacific Northwest Coast collections at the Museum of Anthropology. So one of the first things that I kind of pointed out was that, like, it is a university museum. So, like, I don't know. Yeah, like, is it hard to get money from UBC because it's like, oh, maybe they're not going to be prioritizing, like, art or ethnology where they could be prioritizing, like, other faculties and stuff? And so I got a super interesting response, which is that the UBC doesn't actually directly fund everything MOA does, and in fact, it doesn't fund it at all. So it gets a large portion of their active revenue from door admission, and then like the rest is mostly like applying for municipal funding, the Vancouver Foundation, provincial funding, federal funding, and yeah. So and then, Oh, yeah. So most of the support that they get from UBC is through, like, plant operations and taking care of the building. So, like, construction and stuff like that.
And I know they just had a big rebuild of the building as well.
Which, yeah.
I'm just saying that as a callback to what we were just talking about with, like, these spaces. Because the MOA is also, like, kind of a big deal, like, architectural building, mm-hmm. like the Polygon would be. It was the Arthur Erickson building. So it's, like, known for that as well as what it houses, but I think the MOA is like a really interesting thing to bring into this discussion because I would really strongly hesitate to call it an art gallery, but it's also like this tension between these, you know, things we're calling artifacts, a lot of them are culturally considered art, or we're calling it art and they're considered more like tools or like something like that. So it's like, who's putting these labels on? And I don't know, Mickey, obviously you can shed more light onto this. What did Professor Kramer have to think about everything?
Yeah, that was another thing. One of the first things she said was that, it is a Museum of Anthropology, but in the name, but at the same time, she would push back on that and say that art museums and anthropology museums can overlap in what they display. So I think another interesting thing is that the value of like an anthropology museum sometimes is seen a little bit differently compared to like an art museum. And so like that changed also historically how like Northwest Coast Indigenous people wanted their like belongings and treasures to be represented. So I guess it was kind of a change from like originally they wanted it to be like, oh, like we make art too. We want that to be seen like we're on like an equal playing field. And then now it's kind of shifted to like a, not everything needs to be for like visual purposes or like visual,
like aesthetics.
Yeah, aesthetics, and I lost my train of thought a little bit.
That's okay.
Yeah, if I could actually just ask a follow-up question or kind of maybe just make a little bit of a statement about what you were talking about earlier about how UBC doesn't actually directly fund the MOA.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I was really shocked to hear about that because when I think about people coming and seeing the campus and all of the campus advertisements and the way that UBC really brands itself is like, look at all these wonderful spaces we have on campus. And they're very proud to display like the BD biodiversity and the MOA. The MOA is really, I would consider, one of the staples, like one of the ones where I know other people are coming to check out the campus. That's one of the main things that they're seeing. So I would like to think that other like spaces on UBC are being appreciated and being visited because of the attraction of the MOA. And to think that UBC is kind of branding it as like, no, this is like our museum, but they don't actually fund it, is a really interesting contrast to me. And I was really shocked to like learn about that.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I heard that they also don't own it.
Yeah.
Through our resident person who worked or who's on exchange right now, Vista, worked at the MOA, and she told me that they don't own the MOA
either. The land is like considered a different space,
which is also very interesting.
So another thing that's kind of specific to anthropology museums is that in the past in North America there's been an idea that they only show non-Western and usually referred to as like cultural objects, which is something we also talked about because like every object is cultural. So, like, saying cultural object is kind of just, like, separating it from, like, oh, it's non-Western, non-Anglo, centric. So, she was saying that
just about how like those definitions are being placed in like certain people's hands. It's definitely like an interesting concept to think about, like who's defining what as art and like what goes into which gallery. Because what we're really doing with these gallery spaces, not to once again hate too much, but like we're putting things in boxes, literally. Like we're literally putting objects into different boxes, and to do that we have to label them as different things, and that means that we have to separate them and we have to draw distinctions. And I don't think this act of drawing distinctions is necessarily productive for what we're trying to do. And I know that we are going to talk a little bit more about some of the tensions that curators, oh my gosh, are faced with when they're preparing their exhibitions, in thinking about having to cater to donors, having to cater to the art world in a larger sense, having to cater to the residents of the neighborhood of the gallery, but also to the audience, to prospective audience members, maybe people that aren't necessarily tapped in to the art world, but that have a say because of like culturally significant themes, or they connect to the material for some reason, or not for some reason, but for a specific reason. So I'm going to get into the interview here with Sean Dacey from the Richmond Art Gallery. So let's take that away.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Would you like to just, first of all, speak to the Richmond Art Gallery? I know you have a couple exhibitions going on right now. Some of the work that you're doing there right now.
We're a nonprofit municipal gallery in Center Richmond, right at the last Candoline stop, Brick House Station. We currently have two exhibitions up right now, one called Dear Plastic, which is a really interesting show. Artists engaging with, you know, plastic is all around us, but using plastic as a material in very complex and interesting ways. There's one artist who basically takes nylon rope and pulls it apart and creates these beautiful intricate weavings. So our other exhibition is by Persimmon Blackbridge, and it's a collaboration with Tangled Art and Disability. And her work responds to climate catastrophe and using found objects to create a room of these figurative installations that may also speak to disabled bodies. So both are on until March 23rd. So we're free. We're a free gallery. So people should come out. Yeah.
And that's so awesome that you're mentioning that you are a free gallery, because something that we've been talking about a lot, that kind of inaccessibility to these art spaces sometimes, to gallery spaces. And we all know the kind of stereotypical like white box gallery and like some of the barriers to access. So do you think that being a municipally run gallery factors into your accessibility, or would you say that those are kind of two separate things?
I feel very lucky to work for the city of Richmond and to work for the Richmond Art Gallery. It's so different than the other jobs I've worked in the past, that our gallery is located in essentially a community center within the Richmond Cultural Center, which is attached to the Richmond Public Library and the Richmond Museum and the Richmond Art Center. So the people that come through our gallery are mainly Richmond residents, families, seniors. You know, as you know, libraries are one of the only free public spaces that still exist. So we have a more general public that walks through our doors, and thus we need to be accessible kind of on all levels. First of all, you know, having the ramps and all of those sorts of accessibility elements, but also thinking about our exhibition programming, you know, really thinking about or prompting artists to really consider the audience walking in who really doesn't have a connection to contemporary art in the same way as people that pay to get into the Vancouver Art Gallery or going out of their way to visit a contemporary art space. So really thinking about exhibitions that have different levels of entry points. You know, whether, you know, we really try to think about how does the work to Richmond? Does it connect to the history of Richmond, the geography of Richmond, current political issues in Richmond? So we like to have those kind of, we like to think about those kind of entry points that anyone could walk in and have a response to the work that they're looking at. So, and also the supports, like being part of a larger, we're part of a larger municipal corporation. So just that ability for support and resources, working with different departments, you know, collaborating with public art, collaborating with the museum, and having expertise and be able to connect artists into the kind of research or the supports they need for their research, I think offers a level of accessibility and support also for the artists.
Yeah. Do you want to speak a little bit more to the kind of duties and weight and responsibility of the curator to pick who to platform, what messages to promote? I know you're just talking a little bit about connecting it to Richmond and making sure that it's something that's approachable to a lot of people who are going to see it. But what are some of the other considerations that go into these exhibitions?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting having worked in many different gallery situations. I think it's always about the context and the subjectivity of the space and the mandate of the space and the understanding the audience of that space. So within the municipal context, it feels a lot easier in a certain way to really hone in or create a frame to curate within. So for us, it is really about that context of Richmond, you know, being on, you know, unceded territory of Musqueam, thinking about the history of Richmond, the settler farming history of Richmond, thinking about the many generations of immigration. I think it creates a lot of fertile ground to develop curatorial ideas out of. I think the interesting thing for us is balancing between our general audience, but also wanting to be part of contemporary art conversation. So wanting to be part of a larger international conversation of what contemporary art is. And so wanting shows that are speaking to that, that are conceptual in nature, that are pushing the boundaries of what art is. And so how do you balance that with an audience? Find striking that balance between that kind of art world dialogue, but then also that community community dialogue is something we try to balance. And I think it does a service to both the artists and our community, because how do we bridge that with contemporary and experimental practices? And I think those are the things that we're thinking about in this context, to how do you create a space that welcomes all of those conversations and brings people together? I really think about the gallery as a, you know, a civic space, as a public space. So how do we create the environment that is welcoming for that?
Yeah, I just want to pull one thing out that you were saying earlier. You were speaking to how this role like differs from other roles you've had in the past. Do you want to get into a little bit of your kind of career and the other kinds of gallery locations you've worked at as well?
Yeah, so I moved out to Vancouver to complete the curatorial studies program at UBC. And out of that amazing program, I was able to get a job running an artist-run center called Access Gallery. And this is a small center in Chinatown. And when I was there, the real focus was, probably still is, a space for emerging artists. So for artists to get their first show, to experiment. And it was a very different context. It was really a space for artists and curators. Very small budget, but a space to experiment, to build community, to get really deep into why we're making what we're making, how you professionalize, you know, it's that kind of stepping stone sort of gallery. And, you know, hosting artist collectives, hosting, you know, mainly local artists. It was a really fun and exciting space to work within, but also had a very specific audience and had its own limitations. And then after that, I worked at the Contemporary Art Gallery in Yale Town as a curator, more focused in outreach and public programming. And once again, I think it had more of an international reach, and we were exhibiting the art of major international contemporary artists. So once again, it really did feel like a space for artists, curators, but more on that national, international level. But it was very interesting because we're in Yale Town, and we're in the main floor of a condo tower, and we're surrounded by residents, and the residents don't understand what we are. They're confused. And so my time there was really about how do we create a more welcoming environment? How do we lean into connecting with local residents? And then the job at Richmond came up, and it was like, well, if that's my real investment and my real interest, that this is the perfect spot because that audience is already there.
That's awesome. I just want to ask a little bit more about some of those inner workings of the Richmond Art Gallery in terms of limitations or benefits of being kind of that civic space.
It's a very interesting context to work within, that I'm a city staff member, and I'm part of a larger department at the city that is sort of linked to the strategic plans of the city of Richmond. And to be, it is a complicated organizational structure. We have a nonprofit association, Richmond Art Gallery Association, which gives us a bit of arm's length from the city and gives us a bit more autonomy. Other city institutions, everything, all press releases have to go through city communications. We'd have to work with the city corporate design. I really feel that all those elements of the city could really stifle our creativity and also our autonomy as an independent arts organization. So it's really kind of striking that balance. All around the world now, we feel like we're fighting the social political issues that we thought maybe we had won already, and Richmond is a center point around that. So, you know, how can the gallery be I'm not sure there's any such thing as a real safe space, but how can we be a welcoming space for, you know, queer, trans, LGBTQ people in a community where there are people actively against those folks, navigating kind of staying out of the politics of city council, I guess, but also wanting to welcome them in and advocate. I mean, I think within my role, we have an opportunity to advocate to different levels of government because I'm already integrated within it. And, you know, as you know, arts funding in Canada is pretty frozen right now, and it's a really intensive time. So, you know, we are advocating to our MLAs on the provincial level and on a municipal level. So from my perspective, it's also thinking about how can you play the political game becomes a broader conversation of why is art important in our community, and why is contemporary art, or why is the presentation of visual art important for a community like Richmond? So they're exciting dialogues to have, and I'm happy to be part of them. Yeah, I think, you know, for your listeners, you know, now's a really important time for people that know the importance, that people who like to make art, to really advocate to all levels of their government, to support our galleries. Art is so important, I think, to show the alternative paths that we have to get through these hard times. So just get out and support, and actually, love on all of our local galleries. So yeah, I think that's it.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyber web? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
Loneliness. All right. Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to The Art Beat, and this is our limited series, Everything But the Piece. You just heard a lovely interview by Sean Dacey from the Richmond Art Gallery. And I want to say a huge thank you to him. And I'm passing it over now to Django, who wants to talk about the Vancouver Art Gallery a little bit, respective to the Richmond Art Gallery.
So take it away. Earlier I talked about the Vancouver Art Gallery. And we talked about kind of how it's this, like, with the zine thing, how it's kind of like a paywall to go in. And I want to contrast that with the Richmond Art Gallery. And as it was said in the interview, and I'll reiterate it now, I grew up in Richmond. I went to that building a lot, which is the same building as the biggest library in the city. And so it is like a super awesome zone for children and young families to go to and be able to go to the library, which is an awesome thing in general, but then also be able to be exposed to the art gallery in the same space, as well as the Richmond Museum, which is also right there. And that was very formative for me as a child growing up, because it was a rotating museum thing, so I could learn stuff about the city that I was from, but also the art gallery had a bunch of cool programs that I remember going to as a kid that really I think shaped me in a way that I'm kind of not really realizing until right now, being re-exposed to the fact that it exists. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I just think public art is really super important to have a public space for art in a city like that is so cool.
Yeah, the concept of accessibility in art is so much more than physical accessibility. Obviously, it includes that, but it's also just making sure that there's no barriers to engage with the material, because there are so many themes that can be transmitted through art in more successful ways than by television or just reading the newspaper or something like that. Art is supposed to be engaging, and I think that it is really important to pay attention to these spaces and to kind of support them if you can, and at the very least go visit them, go see what's up. Richmond Art Gallery, huge shout out. That's pretty much it for today. So thank you so much for sticking around this episode. We are going to be continuing our limited series next week with a little bit of a change in our course, looking at the ways that artists kind of navigate away from the institution or outside of those institutional pressures. So thank you so much for listening, and have a good evening.
Some mud on my jeans, two bloody elbows, the sunshine's killing me. Nobody knows, nobody seems to know who it was. Walked up the mugs here, asked them just what it seemed. He said, I saw you stumbling off with that river queen. Bob said, I'm lucky that I got out alive. Bob said a lot of things, but nothing about last night. Nobody knows, nobody seems to know. At the bar on the bay, he put a coin in the jukebox.
Vous écoutez Café Musique à CITR 101.9 FM, en diffusion du territoire non cédé de la nation Musqueam à l'Université de la Colombie-Britannique Vancouver. L'émission est produite en collaboration avec le Centre de la Francophonie de UBC. Vous pouvez en apprendre plus sur le centre et ses activités à francophonie.ubc.ca. Tonight, I'm gonna have my